I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 29th of August, and it's time for another All Things Political. We have a lot to talk about this hour and are pleased to have Ashley, who was on the show a long time ago, and she should have been on more recently, but we'll make up for that in the time ahead. Professor Julia Azari is with us, Associate Professor and Assistant Chair in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. Her research and teaching interests include the American presidency and American political parties. She's a regular contributor at the political science blog, The Mischiefs of Faction, and her work has appeared in the Washington Post's Monkey Cage blog and also in Politico. She wrote a very interesting article in Politico, which we'll talk about during the course of the hour. She asks, why hasn't the Republican Party collapsed? Well, she says we shouldn't be asking whether the GOP is falling apart. We ought to be wondering why it isn't. And she's done a very interesting historical look at both the Republican and Democratic Party. We will talk about that. And we have a lot of other things on the table as well. Donald Trump seems to be giving different messages on immigration, and it's hard to figure out exactly what his position is on immigration. The Clinton Foundation questions continue to follow Hillary Clinton about the foreign contributions, particularly if Hillary Clinton becomes president. Frank Bruni had an interesting piece yesterday looking at whether or not Donald Trump has created a movement. He would suggest that perhaps he is not, that he's a candidate who's got a message, and once his candidacy is over, unless he wins, if he loses, there won't be a movement behind him. We'll talk about that. And we'll also talk about whether or not Hillary Clinton has been receiving a lot of scrutiny, the kind of scrutiny she should, because the press has all its attention on Donald Trump. So those are just a few of our areas of conversation this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org. Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. Professor Azari, welcome back. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Your piece in Politico is really interesting because it has so much history behind it. You write, to be a political scientist in the Trump era is to constantly ponder one big question, whether the Republican Party is in a state of collapse. Could the growing split over Trump bring about the end of one of our major political parties?
Yeah, so one of the things that I have been thinking about as I've been asked this question over and over again in the last year or so is why our political parties are so incredibly stable. And as you point out, I wrote about both parties in the piece. Both of our parties are the same, kind of have the same organizational form that they had when they began, the Democrats in the 1830s and the Republicans in the 1850s. And they were both created for very different purposes than what their supporters or whoever in the electorate might think of them today, and very different kinds of political problems and policy problems than we face today. So I wanted to look at a couple moments in which either party really might have fallen apart due to being divided, due to being out of power. And I wanted to look at why didn't they fall apart? And I don't have one answer for that, but our parties are very durable, they're very resilient, they're very flexible. And so I think the more interesting question is why do we still have these two parties? Mm.
Has the Republican Party ever seen a candidate similar to Donald Trump?
So that's another really good question. I feel like that is the second most common question.
Is it?
Because it's a really important one. The comparison that most people have drawn is Goldwater, and the Goldwater comparison is instructive because there were so many powerful elites within the Republican Party in 1964 who were not in favor of Goldwater. That's really the unusual situation. That kind of the defining quality of a political party is that it nominates a presidential candidate. And so when you think of the important people in the party, those are the people who we expect to be handpicking those candidates. Obviously, the primaries have changed that, and this year they've changed it a lot. So no, there hasn't really been in either party a candidate like Trump who's come in with really no previous affiliation and against the wishes of the party elites, and won the nomination.
Let's talk about the issue of race, and we're going to hear Hillary Clinton gave a major address on the alt-right last week. You mentioned in your political piece the North-South coalition and the fracturing of it in 1948 and in 1968, Governor Strom Thurmond, the Dixiecrat, in 48, and George Wallace in 1968. Are we seeing, do you see an element of race in the Republican platform in Donald Trump's campaign right now that is all reminiscent of either of those times in history?
I do. And, you know, I wrote back in the spring, I wrote a piece at 538.com where I also write pretty regularly. And that was on when parties divide, how parties split. And one of the things I found is that if you need the South in your coalition, eventually you're going to face a party split. So this is true before the Civil War when both parties had North and South elements in their coalition. And then it's been typically, historically, the Democrats have been the party of the South, and then they've patched in whichever other parts of the country they've been able to be competitive. And that, after 1968, that became the Republicans gradually. So the idea that there's a distinct Southern constituency with distinct policy preferences that are heavily rooted in race, but maybe not totally limited to that. That's an old idea, and I think the Republicans are coming up against that. One thing I think is really instructive is to look at the primary map. Now, Trump did really well in the primaries all over, but where Cruz was able to defeat him in a couple of instances is primarily in the West, whereas Trump was really strong in the South. If you'd asked me a year ago, I would have predicted the opposite, but I would have predicted that split. The South and the West have been the two geographic main components of the Republican constituency since about 1980, and they're not the same. The voters there are not the same.
Frank Bruni had an interesting piece yesterday looking at whether or not Trump has coattails, and his analysis was he doesn't even have a windbreaker. Does he have, do you think, something along the lines of a movement that he brags about? Does he have positions that will last if he loses long after that?
So this is really fascinating because on the one hand, there doesn't seem to be much organization going on. One of the things that I was listening to Republican campaign professional Stuart Stevens talk about this, and he was saying that, you know, Trump doesn't have anything resembling a modern campaign. So you kind of need that to have a movement. It's not just about words, it's also about mobilizing people and building a structure. And that's really lacking. But on the other hand, I think there are some compelling arguments that Trumpism has opened up something within the electorate and within a portion of the electorate that seems to be confined to the Republican Party at the moment, that is really about race, immigration, free trade. There's a whole range of issues there, law and order, those kinds of questions, and that the discourse has shifted, and that now that that's been, those ideas have kind of been released into the mainstream political discourse, they'll still be there, even if Trump is defeated in November.
And what about the issue of immigration? Why would this man, who really built his whole base on the basis of his stance on immigration, change his stance or use different words, as his campaign spokesman said? It's not a different philosophy, it's just different words. Well, they're different words that seem to indicate a different philosophy. What's he doing with that, do you think?
So there are a couple of theories for this, and one of them is just that this is what we're seeing. This is someone who's just not experienced in national campaigns. And Trump's previous career, you know, has entailed a lot of different things, being an entertainer, being in business, but that hasn't been articulating a kind of long-term stable philosophy over time. So this isn't that uncommon when you look at people who don't pay much attention to politics. This is actually a really common thing. If you ask them, you ask someone on one day or using some words, you know, what do you think about immigration? And they'll say one thing and then you use different words, or you ask someone they're in a different mood and they give you a totally different answer. It's quite common for people who are not not super attentive to politics. And so in that sense, Trump is kind of displaying that behavior. We're not used to seeing that from people who are running for president. So I think that's one possibility. The other possibility is something I've kind of been playing around with, is the idea that the Trump campaign, you know, is not an especially policy detail heavy campaign. And more than a policy or more than a position on immigration, there's a position on immigrants. And that position on immigrants is symbolic. It's an idea about what the immigrants that Trump described in his now pretty infamous campaign announcement speech, what those individuals are like. And their impact. And it seems to very much symbolically cue into feelings people have about a changing demographic America, feelings people have about crime and law and order. And some of that we've seen, it's old hat in American politics, but also some of the kind of change and taking our country back kinds of themes are familiar from the Tea Party movement over the last 6 years. So that's, I don't know, I haven't had a chance to think about that very much, so here I am saying it on the radio. But I think that's something I'd like to think about more, is Trump's position is less about immigration policy and more about immigrants.
Mm-hmm. It's an interesting analysis. Let's listen to a little bit of what Hillary Clinton said in a very somber address last week in Reno, I believe it was, talking about the alt-right movement and Trump's alliance with this movement, which nobody knew really it was a movement until it was described as an alt-right movement last week. I'm wondering what you think of what she had to say. Here's Hillary Clinton last week.
Everywhere I go, people tell me how concerned they are by the divisive rhetoric coming from my opponent in this election. And I understand that concern, because it's like nothing we've heard before from a nominee for President of the United States from one of our two major parties. From the start, Donald Trump has built his campaign on prejudice and paranoia. He is taking hate groups mainstream and helping a radical fringe take over the Republican Party.
Professor Azari, is he?
So, fascinating question there. I think on the one hand, there's some truth to what she's saying. Like I said, there does seem to be this this set of ideas that's been unleashed by the Trump candidacy. On the other hand, I have two responses to that speech that she gave in Reno, other than that it keeps making me have a Johnny Cash song stuck in my head. Clinton, not just in this speech, but throughout the DNC, the Democratic Party has really tried to take back the mantle of patriotism and mm-hmm. build up their own sort of democratically oriented American national myth. I don't say myth with any sort of sense of judgment, but just the sense of, you know, what America is as an idea. And there are some really interesting ideas there, but also I do think here we need to dive a little bit into that idea of a myth. When she says that we've never heard anything like this from a national party candidate, that's sort of technically true, but that's because before the middle of the 20th century, the idea of social equality across people of different races, of different genders, those ideas were not expressed in mainstream politics. And even the Republican Party, which was founded in the 1850s on the idea of racial equality, or not of racial equality, of ending slavery, was not about racial equality and did not embrace the notion that white people and African-American people could live as social equals. So this is a very new notion in mainstream American politics. And one thing that we're seeing is that it's not one that's taken over universally. So I think we have to be honest with ourselves about what our history is.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that kind of goes along with that is in a different part of the speech, she referred to Bob Dole's acceptance speech at the 1996 Republican convention, where he points to the exits and says, if you're a racist, that's where you can go. I think that was a really powerful piece of rhetoric when Dole said it in the 1990s, and it's powerful for her to bring that up. But it also does kind of gloss over institutional racism. It makes it sound like racism is just a thing that, you know, some people are hateful and that's what racism is. And of course, that is one thing that racism is, but it's also geographic segregation, it's institutional inequalities, and so it does kind of ignore some of those issues, although Clinton has addressed some of that on the campaign trail.
We have spent and I'm using we meaning the whole media, but we have spent an inordinate amount of time listening to Donald Trump. We've carried his speeches. We talk about him all the time. He says things that are so eye-popping that you have to talk about him. And so we talk about him and talk about him and talk about him. Maureen Dowd had ended her column yesterday by saying many people believe that Trump is so demented and dangerous that any criticism of Hillary should be tabled or suppressed, that her malfeasance is so small comparing to his that it's not worth mentioning. But that's not good for her or for us to leave so many things hanging out there without her ever having to explain herself.
So that's fascinating. And in some sense, as a matter of describing what's actually happened in the course of the campaign, I couldn't disagree with Dowd more. I think that Hillary Clinton is held to a very high standard, and that she faces criticism for things that I don't know that a man in her position would. I think there's very much the gendered component. I think there's also, and not totally undeservedly, a lot of baggage left over from her affiliation with her husband's administration, from the Obama administration. You know, she's just a candidate that's linked to every, you know, all the recent Democratic administrations. And so I think, you know, I don't think that there's been any kind of lack of scrutiny. And part of that is that she had a very, you know, intense primary. And so I don't think, you know, I just don't think that that that's true. I think there are constant conversations about whether she's trustworthy and whether she's a good steward of both the left and the center of the Democratic Party in a way that I don't see other center left Democrats like Joe Biden necessarily having to answer for. So, yeah, I think, you know, and David Brooks writes, it seems, every week about some aspect of Hillary Clinton's personality and why isn't she nicer and more authentic and having more hobbies. So, yeah, I mean, not to rant about the media treatment of Hillary Clinton, which perhaps lots of people would like to do. I don't agree with that at all.
You don't think that Trump dominates the headlines?
I mean, I think that he's dominated the headlines because he says things that are more, a little bit more dog bites man. But I don't think that that there's this lack of scrutiny, lack of questions about Hillary Clinton.
Can you imagine these two debating each other? It's going to happen pretty soon. What in the world is going to happen?
You know, yeah, I kind of have a moment every morning where I wake up and remember that Trump is the Republican nominee, and all the public times that I said it wouldn't be him and it would be Walker or Bush or Rubio. So yeah, I mean, I don't know what will happen. There's been all this speculation that Trump won't show up or he'll do something really outlandish. One of the things that I noticed in the primary is that Trump alternated between doing something really outlandish and then doing something really pretty standard and subdued. And I think that we will see that again in the debates, and it'll keep people watching. And I mean, Trump is a professional entertainer. He knows how to dominate the media cycle. He knows how to keep people watching. And so that's my best prediction, is we'll see some debates where he seems like more or less like a standard candidate, and others where he'll say something really truly outlandish, either during the debate or afterward.
We're going to welcome phone calls. We're going to move on. I read something recently which I thought was interesting, looking at, and we've talked about this before on the show, what's going to happen with Senate races. There was a piece about how the Democrats maybe could have offered better candidates and had a better chance of winning in some important states in this country, and that the Democratic field doesn't seem to be being groomed very well for major positions. I think that's been a criticism of Democrats in the state of Wisconsin, but also nationally. So as a result, we have a lot of Republican legislatures and a lot more offices where you can groom somebody for national office because there are so many state offices. Why hasn't, well, we'll see if our guest agrees with that and why the Democrats haven't groomed people. We're welcoming phone calls. Here is how you reach us, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter. Twitter as well, at Kay Dunn Show. Lots of questions for you. Do you think that Donald Trump will leave behind a movement? Should he be president, he'll be able to form a new movement, or should he lose, he'll still leave behind a movement that will live on? Those issues, and some of the issues are the same to people who voted for Bernie Sanders, certainly the economic inequality issue, very strong. Will there be a movement on the Democratic side as well? Is the press giving Hillary Clinton the kind of scrutiny that she should be receiving, or is most of the attention on Donald Trump? And do you think that's okay because of who he is, or do you think that that's too much and we need to know more about her? Well, those are just a few of the things that we'd like to hear from you about. Here's how you reach us again, 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to All Things Political on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Professor Julia Azari is our All Things Political guest today. She's Associate Professor, Assistant Chair of Political Science for Marquette University. She's a regular contributor to 538 and the political science blog, The Mischiefs of Faction. And she's also written for Politico and The Washington Post. All right, let's go to phone calls. And we start with Betty in Oak Creek. Hello, Betty.
Thank you for taking my call. I am 80 years old. I remember when in school when they taught history. I remember World War II, and I remember how the world was in the 40s. Trump is dangerous. We will have a war over here, and he is crazier than a lunatic. He is just another Hitler, Mussolini. And that's all I have to say.
All right, Betty. Thanks very much for your call. Professor?
So, I think, yeah, so it's useful to hear perspectives from people who have a living memory of those times. So I appreciate the caller offering that perspective. I think it's really hard to know. I'm trying to be really humble in my ability to predict things. I think I said before that I had predicted that we would never get to this point with Trump. I thought he'd get bored. I didn't think that someone who doesn't have a record as a professional politician would be able to become a major party nominee under those circumstances. I was wrong. You know, there are elements there of a lack of understanding of some democratic norms. And that, I think, is what makes a lot of people who normally would probably vote Republican feel concerned about Trump in particular. I think that, you know, that's a really concerning feature of his candidacy. I don't know that we know for sure how deep that runs or how much he would be able to enact those ideas in office, or if he would even be inclined to do that.
How many Republicans do you think are going to say, I'm not voting for Trump? And does Hillary get a good percentage of those, or do a lot of people just not vote top of ticket?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I think it's going to be a mix. And so I think we'll probably spend a long time disentangling this. And to give that some context, some political scientists are still fighting about who Ross Perot took votes from in 1992. It's a really difficult question to answer. I think that we've certainly seen some very prominent Republicans say that they will not support Trump, and I imagine that they will take, you know, some of their supporters with them. I don't know what percentage that will be. I do think, you know, one of the things we're seeing is that Gary Johnson, the Libertarian, mm-hmm. is polling pretty well. I think he'll...
He is, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think he will end up with some. I think that for individual Republicans, and this is based on my own kind of anecdotal conversations with Republican friends, there's kind of a mix of people saying, okay, I accept that Hillary Clinton would be a better leader. And I'm not saying that's not my opinion. I'm just quoting my friends. That they accept that Hillary Clinton would be a better leader, but and so they'll probably vote for her if it seems competitive. And people who said that they are not interested in voting for Trump and they will not do that, but they also will have no interest in voting for Hillary Clinton. And then people have their own calculus about what that means in the state where they live.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the answer is I don't know. I think it will be a little bit of a mix of not voting, voting third party, and voting for Clinton.
Thanks, Betty, for your call. Mason in Eau Claire. Hi.
Hi there.
Hi.
I guess I was listening to the radio. I was making a comment, listening to it, and you had I don't know, subject to Donald Trump, and I guess even with Bernie too making a following, I think it doesn't matter if Trump is elected or not. There's still going to be this large percentage of Americans who are maybe not as much informed or just honestly upset with the current political climate, where it seems like even their own representatives, whether they're Democratic or Republican, to them it seems like they're still, you know, they're part of, you know, they're one of the band, or they're part of the system. And I think that that's why there's a lot of distrust, even for people who are as college-age kids myself. I know a ton of people who were super pro-Bernie, and they will not touch Hillary Clinton. They think that she represents everything that, Bernie's basically whole position was against. And just kind of stuff like that, I think, really is what's going to decide.
Yeah, I think that you're right. There's a big millennial future here in politics, and so Bernie's contribution, we may have forgotten about him, but certainly who he inspired isn't going away.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's an important contrast point. And there was a really fascinating, so can I refer you to another podcast?
Sure.
Brian Beutler's podcast on The Atlantic, Primary Concerns. He had some of the people who worked for Bernie on a couple of weeks ago to talk about the movement that built and some of the campaign professionals who were kind of cutting their teeth. So I think that, in particular, this caller would really find that interesting. I think that's probably true. I think that there was a little bit more of a movement organization built up by the Sanders campaign. And that is because, as much as Senator Sanders positioned himself as an outsider, the man is a professional politician. And I say that with, you know, I don't say that as a bad thing. He knows what he's doing. I also think that this kind of goes back to my Politico piece. I think the strength of the Sanders movement really illustrates that there's a group of people who would like to see a Democratic Party that's about the left. That's really about income inequality. And the Democratic Party was founded, again, in the 1830s to be the party to push back against a growing federal government. So much has changed. And then it was kind of partially reformed in the 1930s by FDR, but that was kind of built on top of this old organization. And so I do think there's room. I don't know what form that will take, but I do think that there is a tension there. There's an agitation there.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not inclined to dismiss what the caller's saying, although I will note that 20 years ago when I was in college, a lot of people were saying they were voting for Nader, they would never vote for Gore, and many of those people shuffled to the polls and voted for Hillary Clinton. So I do think there's a little bit of a life cycle effect, but I don't want to dismiss some of that real sentiment around some of the issues that Senator Sanders raised.
And it does go directly to your article, because you talk about the Democrats, and this was on full display at the Democratic Convention, or cobbling together every interest group. Everybody was there, and everybody spoke for a little while. And then you have Bernie Sanders, who's got issue-oriented economic inequality, mm-hmm. number one, and that's what the young people were drawn to. They weren't drawn to this, let's bring everybody together. They were drawn to a specific set of issues, and they are the future, and they're not voting for Donald Trump. I don't know if they'll vote for Hillary Clinton, but I think he has 18% of the millennial vote, which is incredibly low. Mm-hmm. So the question from all of this is, as that generation grows older, does it change the Democratic Party in a significant way?
It might. I'm not exactly sure what the future will hold. And this one of the things when we study different groups of people and how they vote at different moments is disentangling what we call life cycle effect. So what is being a college student versus being someone in your 30s with a mortgage versus being someone looking at Social Security? You know, what are those effects versus what is a cohort effect? What is something that is emblematic of a particular group of people at a, you know, that are a given age, that is a deeply held ideological principle that they'll carry with them through their politically engaged lives. This is a, you know, relatively small minority of people that think that way about politics, but those are the people to whom politics is generally most responsive. I think that we really have to wait to see what's enduring, mm-hmm. and what's not.
Hmm. Interesting. Let's go to, thanks, Mason, John in Milwaukee. Hi, John.
I would like the opinion of the guest about the way Trump knocked out the Jeb Bush and Cruz by bringing up where Jeb Bush said to the crowd, they said, "My brother kept us safe on his watch," and then Trump came right back in his face and said, 9/11 happened on your brother's watch. And then he started the invasion of Iraq under the lie of weapons of mass destruction happened on your brother's watch. And within 2 weeks, Jeb Bush, with all his billions of dollars, folded. And like the guest, the Jesuit Marquette University guest, to explain her opinion on the way Trump has really exposed the guilty parts of the Democratic and Republican parties.
Well, that's a fascinating question, and I should clarify that I'm not an official representative spokesperson for Marquette, or certainly for the Jesuit order.
Right.
Yeah. But I do think that the war question is really, you know, is critically important, and I see the linkage there with the of course with the Jesuit philosophy. And one of the things I think is really interesting, and that got lost in a lot of the din of the debates on both sides, was how prominent the Iraq War was for Republicans and Democrats alike. For the Republicans, I think that the Bush presidency was in some ways a continuation of the philosophical commitments of the Reagan era, and in other ways it revealed the tensions of that era. Because on the one hand, you have a very singular moment after September 11, 2001, in which it wasn't really clear what to do, but in which the sentiment for war on both sides of the aisle was pretty strong. But on the other hand, as the Bush presidency unfolded, I think, and I'll talk about the on the conservative side, the ways in which that wasn't compatible with philosophy of small government, the ways in which that's not compatible with, war isn't compatible, obviously, with a commitment to sanctity of life, the ways in which it's not compatible with, both limited government spending and some of the surveillance stuff that came out of that. I think that tension is apparent, and I think that Jeb Bush was really had some positive things about his candidacy. He was in trouble from the start because his name was very important for him, but also was that deep linkage to this policy decision that's become unpopular even among Republicans. So I don't, I think we're going to wrestle with the Iraq War for a long time. And as I said, I think that Democrats and Republicans alike will wrestle with it in different ways and with different philosophical perspectives. How important that was to the primary vote, I don't know. I don't really know. I think there's a strong possibility that Jeb Bush had been a more dynamic candidate.
Yes, he wasn't very dynamic.
Yeah, he might have overcome that problem.
Thanks, John, for your call. Heather in Sparta. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Heather.
My concern is that the government, so many of the people that we elect, we just don't have the honest issues that we used to have. For example, I have a political science degree too. When Abraham Lincoln was running, he was known for Honest Abe. But today, people all seem to, the electorate listens and they all pick what they want to hear. But now it seems like those who are loudest or have the money, such as with this Clinton Foundation deal, they're the ones that get heard. And then we see the rioting because people are getting disinterested. They feel disenfranchised. But I think I would rather myself have someone that I disagreed with that told what he was going to do or she was going to do than has a proven policy of lying. For example, I had worked in a prison, and there was much training with all of the people working. And if you are ever caught doing fraternization with an inmate, it was charged against you because you were said to have power over them, whether you were a kitchen aide, a teacher, or an officer. But when President Clinton was over his aide in the White House, he didn't get thrown in prison. facing many of ordinary citizens for a similar activity.
Okay, let's, you got a lot of things here. Let's talk about two of them. One is honesty. Do you think that we are more so than, and you're a student of history too, in an era where there are all kinds of statements made mm-hmm. with no basis in honesty, in
so,
the truth?
Yeah, that's a great question. In some ways, I think we're living in an era that's got us unprecedented transparency. We know exactly what candidates are doing and saying and tweeting and having for breakfast every second. In contrast, the Lincoln example is really interesting. Honest Abe, may have been a very honest person in his in his life and straightforward in his politics in some ways, but was also a master of the system of patronage. Was a master of the political machines that we replaced in the 20th century, so we could have more honesty and transparency. So I think that honesty and transparency in politics are very tricky, and there is no politics without power. So that sometimes results in abuses of power, as the caller was talking about. But yeah, I mean, I think that's, there's a real danger in valorizing the past too much in terms of how honest politicians used to be. Anytime you're dealing with a high stakes game, there's going to be abuses of power, and sometimes you can't always be totally straightforward with the truth. It's kind of sad, but true.
And then she brings up, she's married to him, of course, but she brings up Monica Lewinsky, and there was talk some time ago that Donald Trump was really going to throw the book at her on his affairs and how she responded mm-hmm. to Jessica Flowers and others. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's still forthcoming? And the second part of the question is, does she have difficulty in trying, because that's the Clinton mm-hmm. we remember, and we do, some people don't remember him, they're too young, but he had, a very centrist kind of Democratic administration, mm-hmm. and so is she tied to that, into those policies in some ways?
I think that, I think, I forget what percentage of the electorate is too young to have remembered, the first Clinton administration, but it's a fairly high percentage, and so there's, I think there's that. I think that Clinton has tried really hard to move on from some of those policy questions. And I think that more importantly, the Democratic Party has moved in a different direction. That's a very different era in the Democratic Party. As far as Lewinsky and some of Bill Clinton's scandals, I'm just old enough to remember the Lewinsky scandals. And if I remember the 1998, those midterms, those first election I voted in, were the first time since FDR that the president's party picked up seats.
Right.
So I think that was kind of the reaction to mm-hmm. the first round of that. And now that it's 20 years stale, I don't see it gaining a lot of traction. So it's interesting because one of the themes that I think is emerging here is this real emphasis on Hillary Clinton's linkage to the past, and particularly to her husband's administration, and also her as a person. And I think that going back to what a couple of callers ago brought up about war, I think there's some deeper policy questions to tangle with, and that's where, Hillary Clinton, of course, deserves great scrutiny as she's running for the highest office in the land, and that, that's an area where it would be much better to focus on policy issues.
Mm. But don't you think that part of her problem is that she has had a hard time letting us know who she is as a person? So people talk for her involvement with children and putting families mm-hmm. first and women first, etc. And yet when it comes to the reality of Hillary Clinton, she just can't break through the TV screen as somebody who's genuine. A lot of people have said, you need to be a more fully human being. And they don't have a picture of who she really is. Is that a fair criticism of her?
I don't think so. Honestly, I think it's really hard to break those kinds of criticisms away from the gender component.
Really?
Yeah, I do. And I think that the idea that, you should be more softer and more human and smile more. I mean, it all has a very strong gendered component. She's been in public life for 20 years. I think, more than that. I think we know who she is. She's been in public life for, for 40 years, really. I also think that if you compare her with Obama, this is something where Obama has consistently scored very well. people don't always like him or like the direction of the country, or they don't always like his policies, but they like him. They think he's authentic. Right. They think he's genuine. He's open. Although it's funny, he's in other ways, I think, personally also very enigmatic. I don't know that it's done him any good politically. You know, I think that he's had the same kinds of struggles politically that have, some have been his fault, some have not been. That he would if he had a different kind of political persona. So I don't know that I think it's that important for governance. And again, we don't have any precedent for a woman as a major party nominee, but I really think that anytime we offer a critique of someone's personality, we ought to think about the lenses that we bring to that question.
Mm-hmm. More phone calls in a moment. You're listening to All Things Political here on the Ideas Network for this Monday, the 29th of August. And our guest is Professor Julia Azari. She's at Marquette University, assistant chair of the Political Science Department and an associate professor. And her research and teaching include the American presidency and American political parties. She writes for a number of publications, including the Washington Post, Politico, 538, and is a regular contributor to a political science blog, The Mischiefs. So we're going to take more phone calls momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Ray in Milwaukee, hello.
Well, I kind of wish I had called in next hour, because of course every election that I can think of has been rigged in some way or another in the last 50 years. But
every single one, Ray?
I believe that. Oh yeah,
really?
The voting, the way the people in Milwaukee have to wait in lines while people in the suburbs can waltz through these beautiful, clean gymnasiums at their high schools, yet I got to wait 2 or 3 hours in the morning to vote on. Especially on the presidential elections. Yeah, this is all. I don't even want to get into it in a way.
Okay.
I wish I had called next hour.
All right, I'm sorry, Rick. Go ahead this hour.
But let me talk about what I wanted to say.
Sure.
The Clinton Foundation. It's so easy to make fun of Trump because his stupidity is right on the surface, and it's just, you know, you're shooting at the low fruit there. But when you look at Hillary and Bill and the rottenness and corruption that's going on in their foundation, for instance, this information I, by the way, got from NPR. The EpiPen scenario with $600 now to buy 2 EpiPens for your child who might die. For some reason, the Clinton Foundation took $250,000 in donations from that very same pharmaceutical company. Yet, as all this was happening, they didn't have a word to say as the prices went up and up. And the Clinton Foundation taking money from overseas countries, for instance, like Saudi Arabia, where women are second-class citizens. They can't drive cars. They took money from the Russians so the Russians could buy uranium here from America and own a uranium processing plant here. And for some reason, her husband went over to Russia and made a speech where he was paid $250,000 for a one-hour speech. We really, really need to scrutinize Mrs. Clinton since she's going to be anointed king, as it apparently, it appears that's what's going to happen.
Ray, thanks very much for the call. Their hands are dirty.
Yeah, I mean, that certainly is the appearance of that. We've known the Clintons had this foundation. We've known the Clintons have been close to power, have been in power, have had connections with, as the caller points out, different moneyed interests with different foreign governments. I kind of go back to this idea that that's pretty much, you know, what you get when you are dealing with lots of power. And to some extent, there's, you know, I think one of the more insightful comments about this has been that this is really a scandal of optics, right? Is there actually an example in which there was undue influence? People try to buy access. We have protected that as a society, the idea that you can buy access to people of power and you can buy communication, that's a First Amendment right. It's not 100% clear how that applies when we're talking about foreign governments or individuals, but nevertheless, that is a freedom that we protect. Does it look bad? It certainly looks bad, and it certainly does look like there are lots of connections among different powerful people in the country and in the world. You know, I can't answer for other people how important that should be. If something looks bad, or whether there's sufficient evidence that something actually undue influence was actually used.
Mm. Except that it adds to this don't trust her, right? And her numbers are very high there. It's got to be a part of it, don't you think?
Mm-hmm. For sure. Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, this is the nominee. This discussion came up in what was a competitive primary. So I'm not exactly sure what advice to give now. We know all of this. We spend a lot of time, like I said, I think we're in an era of unprecedented transparency and communication.
Ray, thanks for your call. And Jeff in Madison, hi.
Yes, wonderful show. You know, the Trump movement has continually expressed such disdain for all things politically correct to the point that his followers in reaction seem to love to state what is so clearly politically incorrect, or at least in my opinion, politically incorrect, without any concern for who might be hurt. And I've been wondering, post-Trump, because I'd like to imagine a political landscape without him, how this dynamic has impacted our political discourse in the future. Are we fated to listen to people spouting hatred as their right, responsibility, and obligation, or are we going to move by it somehow? I'd like to hear your guests just think about that. Thanks.
Thanks, Jeff.
Yeah, so I think that's a good question, and that's where I really think there's the potential for the lingering Trump effects. I think that something has been opened up, and there has been a kind of strain of discourse that's now out there in American politics, where people are you know, saying the silent parts out loud. And I think that there is another round of a reckoning to be had about the structure of society, that it really hasn't been very long since it wasn't acceptable to talk about racial and gender hierarchies and other things in some ways. And I think that's sort of what we're seeing with, you know, to break down what political correctness seems to mean. When people use that phrase, they seem to mean, here's this thing we all know is true, but we're not allowed to say it. And, you know, most of the time, the thing that's coming after that is not something we all know is true. It's something a lot of people don't believe, but clearly some people do. And so underneath that, we have to reconcile in our democratic society those two sets of beliefs about how things ought to work. I don't think we're getting around that. I think we're going to have to reckon with that.
I just want to spend the last minute. We only have a minute left, and I wanted to be sure to talk to you about whether or not the Democrats have not really spent the last few years, and David Axelrod has said that Democrats have done a poor job. He takes his share of responsibility in not being as focused as Republicans on building the grassroots mm-hmm. to make sure there are lots of really good candidates for office.
Yeah, I think that's right, and I don't entirely know why that is, but Republicans have been tons better than Democrats at building and kind of building up their farm team. They've been more successful at the state level in a whole bunch of different ways, so they have more people holding statewide office. Of course, this, you know, sort of over-recruitment bit them in 2016, but I do think also to echo some of the concerns that callers have raised about Secretary of State Clinton, same thing. They under recruited and consolidated around her nomination in a way that may not be fair or ideal either. Yeah, I think that's true. I think it's very telling that the two candidates competing for the Democratic nomination this year were both about 70 years old.
Right.
Whereas the Republican field, you have they ultimately nominated someone in that same age bracket, but they had a lot more age diversity moving up. So I think what this really illustrates is party organization is important. It's not just about the ideas. It's also about building up a movement.
Right. Thank you so much for being with us. Join us again. We got months to go before we rest. Professor Julia Azari, Associate Professor, Assistant Chair of Political Science for Marquette University, our guest for All Things Political this hour. And thanks to Marika Saval for producing this hour. Thanks to KP Whaley for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. A reminder, tomorrow during this hour, he's written a really interesting book. John Dickerson will be with us. He is the host of Face the Nation. His mom, Nancy Dickerson, was the first political reporter for CBS News very early on and really good at what she did. So John is with us tomorrow, first hour.